it is me who should be thanking you for this kind invitation, and I'm honored by the Haus der Kultur in der Welt, and I'm grateful both to Rasa and to Kuo for... Oh, yes. I am honored by the Haus der Kultur in der Welt, and I am grateful to Rasa and to Kuo for this invitation. Initially, the idea was that the talk might not be on the educational cooperation between the Soviet Union and Africa in general, but on the Patrice Lumumba University. Because probably you have heard of it, the Patrice Lumumba University was, when it comes to Soviet education aid to the Third World, then the first university that comes to our mind is the Patrice Lumumba University. And indeed, it was very important. It was founded precisely at the moment of African independence in 1960, and it was rechristened the following year, Patrice Lumumba, after the slain Congolese national leader. It was the first university that welcomed hundreds of students from Africa, Asia, Latin America, and from the Middle East. At the opening ceremony of that university, the president of the Soviet Union, Secretary General of the Communist Party, addressed the students and told them that this university is created by the Soviet Union for you, and it is meant to assist the peoples of Asia, Africa, and Latin America to train their own engineers, professors, doctors, and scientists. So apart from these proclamations, apart from these internationalist proclamations, powerful ideological and geopolitical considerations motivated the Soviet cultural offensive in the Third World. And its goal, if we might summarize it, was to create a socialist-minded and pro-Soviet intelligentsia. Nevertheless, besides these political considerations, in terms of students' training, the outcome was extremely important. In the 1960s, for example, as you can observe in this table, already in the 60s, the Soviet Union was an important destination for African students. In 1978, if you see lower in the middle of the table, the Soviet Union was already hosting more students from, almost as much students from Africa as the United Kingdom, a former colonial power with long established interests in Africa. And by the end of the Cold War, something that we have completely forgotten, in 1988 and 1991, there were more students from sub-Saharan Africa in the Soviet Union than in the United States. Who remembers this period today? Until the dissolution of the Soviet Union in December 1991, more than 43,000... Yes, more than 43,500 students from sub-Saharan Africa had graduated from Soviet schools, and 47,000 from North Africa and the Middle East. The overwhelming majority in universities and technological or medical schools. Now, if we include those who graduated in 1993, that means 2 years after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, which is legitimate because these people had had studied most of the time for the longer period in the Soviet Union, but they graduated in the post-Soviet countries, then we can estimate that 55,000 graduates from sub-Saharan Africa and 60,000 graduates from North Africa and the Middle East had studied in the Soviet Union until that time. They had taken their degrees because other people went there, they never took their degrees anyway. So in this picture, it is incomplete if we don't look at the educational aid the other Eastern Bloc and socialist countries provided to Africa, the German Democratic Republic, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, and the other countries as well. Unfortunately, so far historians have not gathered complete data on Eastern European educational aid. Nevertheless, a glimpse into only one year, which I have found in the archives and I want to share with you today, shows that, for example, in 1967, while there were 5,000 African students in the USSR, there were almost 4,000 students in the rest of the socialist countries. And you can see very big numbers in the GDR, in the German Democratic Republic, more than 1,000, almost 800 in Czechoslovakia, almost 900 students in Poland. These are very important numbers. Throughout the Cold War, thus, the Soviet Union constituted a major host country for Third World students, and the entire Eastern Bloc played a crucial role in the phenomenon that sociologists of education and modernization called the World Educational Revolution. The term World Educational Revolution refers to the spectacular expansion of all levels of education in the post-colonial countries from the 50s to the 80s. The Soviet Union's cooperation with Africa, in particular, is one of the most important chapters of this educational revolution. In this paper, I would like, together with you, to revisit this important chapter and to examine it very quickly, both from the Soviet and from the African sides of the interaction. I will try to sketch out the premises, the character, and the evolution of this educational cooperation. Some thoughts on the cooperation's overall impact on Africa will be discussed with you, mentioned in the conclusion, and discussed with you in our discussion. So let me begin with the visions and the policies of the Soviet-African educational cooperation. At the moment of decolonization, the urgent issue of education figured prominently on the agendas of Africans. The citizens of Africa see in education a means by which their aspirations may be met, and they are willing to sacrifice for the attainment of these means for gaining economic and social development. The delegates who attended the Addis Ababa Conference on the Development of Education in Africa in May 1961 stated in their final report, "The training of African professors, engineers, managers, and other specialists was undoubtedly a prerequisite for economic development. And for the more radical socialist-minded African leaders, this was a prerequisite. Training the national elites was a prerequisite also for nationalizing the foreign companies operating on their soils. Thus, nationalization of the human resources, that means substitution of the foreigners with Africans, constituted a major political, economic, and cultural goal of the Africans. But the Soviet experience for reaching this goal, according to a prominent Nigerian militant and scientist, Abdu Mumuni, the author of this very important book, Education in Africa, published in 1964, Mumuni refers to the Soviet Union as an example and as a possible source of aid. So the example of the socialist countries was very important, was very relevant for Africa. To be sure, these were empowering aspirations, but in the meantime, the reality was that economic and human resources, that means money and elites, were terribly missing, and foreign cooperation, civil cooperation with rich and or richer and more developed countries was urgently needed. Under those circumstances, most African countries signed cooperation agreements with the Soviet Union. Egypt became the first one to sign an agreement in 1957, 1 year after the Suez Crisis, in order to send students to the USSR and to invite Soviet professors who taught at the Noel Institute in Suez. Ghana, Mali, Guinea, and Ghana followed suit. Yes. Between 1960 and 1966, the Soviet Union established the Polytechnic Institute of Conakry in Guinea, the Higher Administrative School of Bamako for the friendly regime of Modibo Keita, the Algerian Oil and Gas Institute in Boumerdès, the Dahir Dar Technical Institute as a gift to Haile Selassie's Ethiopia, and the National Engineering School of Tunisia. Of course, the three first were in countries oriented towards socialism. The Bahir Dar Technical Institute and the National Engineering School of Tunisia were created in countries more oriented toward the West. Among all these schools, the most important was undoubtedly the Algerian Oil and Gas Institute. It was created in 1964. Why? Because graduates of this institute made their career, the engineers who were trained there, they made their career working for the national oil, for the state oil and gas enterprise of Algeria, the well-known Sonatrach. During the 1960s, and with the support of the Eastern Bloc, the Sonatrach, this Algerian company, took over all the oil and gas fields which formerly belonged to French and American companies. In 1971, the government of Houari Boumediene nationalized all natural gas fields in Algeria, and Sonatrach became the state energy monopoly. Boumediene himself stated that, at that time, when he nationalized the foreign companies, that the graduates of the Boumerdès Institute had a major contribution in the nationalization of our oil riches when they replaced the foreign specialists. This is what Boumediene declared at that time. And later in the 1960s, in fact, the Soviet Union also created the National Institute for Light Industry and the Institute of Mining and Smelting at the University of Annaba. So why do I cite these events and these very important changes which were brought about through this educational cooperation? Because I want to make the case, and in particular this institute in Algeria highlights this, how the Soviet African, the Soviet Arab, Soviet Middle East, Soviet Asian cooperation, the Soviet Algerian in this case, cooperation, worked to change the political economy of post-colonial countries in favor of socialism. So this was the rationale behind this cooperation. Now, along with creating schools and sending professors in African and Asian countries, the Eastern Bloc, and the Soviet Union in particular, offered scholarships for studies in the USSR. This was the second part of the Soviet aid. For young Africans, this was, of course, an extraordinary opportunity to receive higher education. Moreover, in the early 60s, fascination with the ideology and the international policies and the technological achievements of the Soviet Union was widespread among African youth. In his broad survey of the opinions, worldview, and aspirations of African students in France in 1962, a Senegalese sociologist, Jean-Pierre Ndiaye, found that 25% of the students admired the Soviet Union, 20% admired China, 12.4% Israel, Cuba, then France, and the United States lags far behind with 3.3%. And the reasons why they admired the Soviet Union, according to the research of Jean-Pierre Ndiaye, it was 35% responded that it is because of the rapid Soviet progress in all areas, for the communist ideology, the scientific achievements of the Soviet Union, such as the Sputnik and Lunik satellites. So this concerns students. Now, political parties and movements. African radical, left-leaning political parties and anti-colonial movements, like those fighting in Cameroon against the pro-France regime, or those fighting in the Portuguese colonies, Mozambique, Angola, Guinea-Bissau, for national independence, decolonization, national independence, also benefited from the aid of the Eastern Bloc and received scholarships. And African governments was another recipient of Soviet scholarships. Here you can see more clearly which are the groups of recipients of Eastern Bloc and Soviet scholarships. So the first was a group of the governments, namely the socialist-oriented governments, but also governments more not radical, conservative, nationalist, Western-oriented, however you might call them. The second group which received Soviet and Eastern Bloc, East German, Czechoslovak, Bulgarian scholarships, were the National Liberation Movement, mainly from the Portuguese colonies or from South Africa. And the third group were the opposition parties. For example, to make it clear, Morocco as a country could receive scholarships, the government of Morocco could receive scholarships from the Soviet Union, but at the same time, some opposition parties, youth organizations, and in some cases, some individual students could also benefit from scholarships, receive scholarships themselves. To be sure, the second and the third group were not offered state scholarships, but rather subventions from social, cultural, and political organizations, which in theory were acting independently of the Soviet government. Lumumba University, which I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, was a school recruiting the majority of its students through the channel of radical and left-leaning organizations or Marxist-inspired parties. Namely, with political criteria. It was recruiting the students, most of them, not all of them, with political criteria. At the same time, students recruited through radical organizations did not attend only Lumumba. They were overall the Soviet Union. In the 1980s, the tens of thousands of students, which you saw on the tables at the beginning of this PowerPoint, were studying, in fact, in Moscow, Kiev, Kharkov, Tashkent, and in tens of universities, technical or medical institutes all around the Soviet Union. To some extent, this reflected the expansion of the state-to-state, the official cooperation between Moscow and the African countries. As mentioned above, most African governments welcomed the Soviet aid. Nevertheless, neither the Western-oriented ones nor the socialist-leaning governments approved the distribution of Soviet scholarships to opposition parties and to anti-government movements. That means that a socialist government, as the Ghanaian government of Kwame Nkrumah, or a more conservative government, as the government in Nigeria, and almost all African regimes protested against the recruitment of leftist students in the Soviet Union. In addition to their protests, they increased border controls. They warned all clandestine students, that their diplomas would not be recognized. Last but not least, they cracked down on opposition parties, independent organizations, and trade unions at home in Africa. To be sure, the Soviet Union never gave up recruiting communists and sympathizers, yet it also came to terms with a new reality for several reasons. Moscow, above all, did not wish to damage its relations with the African governments. Another reason why Moscow refrained from recruiting many students through the channel of political parties and organizations was that some of them who had been recruited as leftist and progressive youths turned out to be very critical of the Soviet Union. They didn't like their stay in the Soviet Union and they protested. For instance, the Ugandan Andrew Amar, who, after he was expelled from the USSR, wrote an acrimonious testimony entitled An African in the USSR. He had been recommended by a leftist student union in the UK, a very strong, the West African Students Union. And the Senegalese Ibrahima Konate, founder of the Pan-African Union in Kiev and torchbearer of protests against racism, earlier had been the secretary of the Federation of African Students in France. Finally, by cooperating with the governments instead of recruiting only leftist students, the Soviets managed to drastically reduce the dropout of students and to elevate the academic standard. Training good specialists and the future elites of African countries was, after all, a major objective of the Soviet educational aid. So let me say a few things about the training of students in the USSR. Somebody who reads the book by Andrew Amar, An African in the Soviet Union, he will be convinced that studies there were basically indoctrination, that the Soviets were obsessed with the indoctrination of the Soviet students, of students coming from non-communist countries. Perfectly fitting into the Cold War mindset, this assumption, however, is not accurate. Until October 1968, all the courses of political and social sciences, the ideological courses, were optional for all the students, the foreign students from non-communist countries. The result was that few students attended the courses of Marxism-Leninism, and even fewer sat for exams. Frustrated with the poor attendance of the political courses, and frustrated also, angry at the political activity of foreign students, the Soviet Ministry of Education decided in October 1968 to make the attendance of these courses compulsory. So the courses became compulsory, in fact, in 68. And from that moment on, and until the reform undertaken in 1989 with the perestroika, with the blessing of Mikhail Gorbachev, the students had to follow a few political and ideological courses, like the history of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, principles of scientific communism, political economy, and scientific atheism, to mention a few. The effects of this decision in terms of indoctrination should, however, not be overemphasized. The teaching of the non-ideological disciplines remained by far the most important task of the faculty members in all the schools. Moreover, studies in the Soviet Union, and this is something that we tend to forget, were longer than in the West for two main reasons. The first was that the students had to spend 1 year at the preparatory faculty in order to learn the Russian language. The second and more important reason was that studies in the regular faculties were longer, for one year longer than in the West. 5 years to study history or mathematics instead of 4 years. The fifth year, was divided between the on-the-job training and the writing of the diploma thesis. For this reason, the degree that the students were awarded by the Soviet university was directly a magister. At the main faculties, the Third World students attended the same courses as the Soviet peers. Nevertheless, as their linguistic skills were still inadequate, they often had to take remedial additional courses to improve the Russian language. Furthermore, mainly as a consequence of the language gap, additional efforts were required to assimilate the contents of the lectures. So these additional efforts meant extra seminaries, more classes, more hours, and even for the weaker students, the weaker students were assigned a supervisor to assist them. Failure to cope with students who failed to cope and fulfill these requirements were confronted with measures such as the reduction of their monthly stipend or the transfer to a technical institute, while those charged with absenteeism, violation of discipline, anti-Soviet behavior, or singled out as troublemakers could end up being expelled of the Soviet Union. I mention all these things because it has been often said in the literature that studies in Eastern Bloc countries, and in particular in the Soviet Union, were not very good, and the degrees were granted very easily to the students. I have studied the archives very carefully. I have not evidence that substantiates this claim. And to tell you the truth, of course, there were bad universities in the Soviet Union, Not all the universities were as good as the Moscow State University, the Kharkov State University, the good, the great technical and medical institutes. But the same is the case also in Great Britain. There, too, there are good universities, and there are universities which are not as good as Oxford and Cambridge. So it is better to think of the Soviet universities not to to generalize, but to study case by case. So the remedial courses, the auxiliary courses, and the disciplinary measures were instituted in the 60s when the dropout rate of the students was very high. However, during the 70s and the 80s, the dropout rate was drastically reduced, and generally it was limited to the preparatory faculties. Between 76 and 81, for example, only 3.8% of all third goal students at the preparatory faculty interrupted their studies for different reasons: academic failure, health, personal reasons, disappointment, returned. The rest successfully completed the program. Even the Soviets admitted that the students and the foreign students had a very high level. Addressing an audience of the communist youth of the Soviet Union, of the Komsomol, the secretary of the Komsomol of the Soviet Union could then affirm that the average academic level of foreign students was perfectly comparable to the level of Soviet students, and in certain cases, even higher. Another important question was that of specializations. Supported by their governments, which generally saw the training of social and political scientists in the USSR with distrust, the majority of students preferred to study engineering, medicine, and hard sciences. For the Soviets, however, training predominantly engineers and physicians, who were less likely to occupy key positions in state mechanism, was not serving the purpose of influencing the course, the political course of African countries. In 1974, as it is mentioned on the PowerPoint, a senior Communist Party official noticed that the predominance of engineers, 50%, and physicians, doctors, 20%, and lamented the fact that few economists, philosophers, journalists, and teachers were being educated in the USSR. So this trend, in fact, went uninterrupted until 1991, when 53% of all foreign students in the Soviet Union studied engineering. Yes. There were also some political schools, purely political schools in the Soviet Union, not academic ones, and these were the schools of the three schools, one of the trade unions, the second one of the communist youth, and the third one was the Institute for the Social Science of the Central Committee of the Communist Party. It is there that party leaders such as Tambo Mbeki and John Mahama, future presidents of South Africa and Ghana, respectively, studied. In any case, despite the reactions after switching the status of the political and ideological courses from options to requirements, the other two major issues, namely the training, the control over the scholarships, and the specializations, were settled in favorable terms for most African governments. As a result, the suspicion gradually dissolved, giving way to mutual understanding and to a stable state-to-state cooperation between Africa and the Soviet Union. African governments seemed genuinely to appreciate not only the large number of scholarships they were offered, but also the Soviet efficiency and organization. Not only were the Soviet authorities able to control the mobility of their nationals and maintain a very low dropout rate, there was relative calm in the USSR, the absence of phenomena such as May 68 or other Western temptations. Moreover, the fact that African students in the West very often did not return to their countries, while those in the East took a flight back upon the completion of their studies, was also an important argument in an era when the problem of the drain the brain drain was looming large. To be sure, the attitude toward studying the USSR remained ambivalent. And in most countries, the Soviet magister was never acquired the standing of Western diplomas. However, there also existed very clearly a sense that the Soviet educational aid was serving the needs of Africa. For all those reasons, and despite some a few abrupt ups and downs due to regime changes, between 1960 and 1990, the number of African students in the USSR grew steadily, and cooperation expanded to almost all African countries. In sharp contrast with the Soviet aid to Latin America and to Asia, which was heavily concentrated on Cuba, Vietnam, and Mongolia and Afghanistan, diversification has been a notable feature of Soviet aid to Africa. It was a consequence of the absence of a close alliance, such as the alliance between Moscow and Havana. At the same time, the fact that Soviet-educated Africans were dispersed all around the continent and greatly outnumbered by their Western-educated colleagues also meant that the political impact of the Soviet aid, Soviet-educated specialists, the Soviet aid was rather limited. Another important factor of this limited impact was that most of the graduates returned after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Overall, I would like to conclude that in the three decades of the Soviet-African educational cooperation, which evolved against the backdrop of the well-established African dependence on the West, such a complex undertaking as a transfer of the Soviet paradigm through the training of a socialist-minded and pro-Soviet intelligentsia indeed had limited, although very significant, effects. In its early stages, the Ethiopian Revolution occurred with the massive participation of students in Addis Ababa. And although active in the Ethiopian movement abroad, the few leftists who had studied in the USSR before played a secondary role. This changed in the late 1980s when Soviet-educated Ethiopians occupied 30% of the high offices in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and almost 50% in economic ministries, commissions, and state enterprises, those educated in the Soviet Union when they returned back to communist Ethiopia, the only African country that... Mozambique also was another case. And the same also is the case for Mozambicans trained in the Soviet Union who returned back they are hired by the socialist government. Then, of course, the regimes collapsed, the chapter closed, and the idea to restructure the African states along socialist lines was abandoned. Thereafter, not only the collapse of communism, but also the subsequent dismantling of the ties between post-Soviet Russia and Africa seemed to vindicate the opinion that the training of Africans in the USSR failed to produce the political effect. Such an assessment, ex post facto assessment, is, however, very problematic. On the one hand, it fails to consider the historically and quantitatively unequal terms under which Soviet-African cooperation developed against the background of Africa's dependence on the West. On the other hand, it is too quick to dismiss the potential in terms of policy influence and networks that might have a group of elites educated elsewhere than in the West, if an alternative political and economic model turned out to be relatively efficacious and sustainable. Speculation, however, is needless because the Soviet-African educational cooperation did have major tangible effects. Historians of the US international relations have shown that the communist involvement spurred the American government and foundations to increase their aid to the less developed countries. If this was an indirect effect, the direct ones are far more significant. Students from the Portuguese colonies studied medicine in the USSR and served in the front line of anti-colonial wars. More than 5,000 physicians from all over the continent were educated in the USSR. The Russia Hospital in Kisumu, Kenya, the Soviet Red Cross Hospital in Addis Abeba, and other hospitals in Somalia, Mali, Ghana, and elsewhere were staffed by graduates of Soviet medical schools. Filmmakers such as Semen Usman, Suleiman Sisse, Abderrahman Sissako studied their art in the Soviet Union. Important painters such as the Malian Mamadou Somme Koulibaly and the Beninese Philippe Abagi. Great architects such as Joseph Vinou, award-winning writers, the Ghanaian Atukwe Yokai, currently still the president of the Pan-African Union of Writers, and the Malian Gaussou Diawara, also award-winning great writer. He also studied theater in the Berliner Ensemble of in Bertolt Berliner Ensemble. After he graduated in Moscow, he came here in Berlin and he also studied for a couple of months here. Numerous lawmakers, ministers, and heads of states, such as the Somali president, the Angolan president, the Congolese president, the Namibian Pohamba, sat on Soviet school benches. Should Eastern Bloc educated politicians be added, for example, the Kenyan Raila Odinga, he's there lower. Yes, he competed in the last elections, if you follow Kenyan politics, but he lost the elections. Or the Malian Alpha Omar Konare, who studied in Poland, the list would be very long. Beyond recalling the names of these well-known graduates, this paper has argued that the credit should first of all go to the thousands of anonymous teachers and engineers, scientists and agronomists who studied in the USSR, and then return to Africa to practice their professions. The golden days of diverse scholarships for African students to study in Moscow, Prague, Warsaw, Budapest, and Belgrade seem to be almost over, and rival scholarships to study in Western countries have been drastically reduced, Ali Mazrui, the great African political scientist, wrote in 1999, adding, "The golden days of Czech, Hungarian, Polish professors at African universities are almost over, and resources for Western visiting professors have been drastically reduced." This paper concludes, together along with Ali Mazrui, in reiterating that Soviet and East European educational aid had been of great importance both for the development of African countries and for several generations of African youth, and that with proper consideration, it should become clear that its effects, both direct and indirect, were major. Thank you very much for your attention.